He stood there in the lobby, beset with restlessness and a sense of anticipation. Suddenly, two men in suits walked up to him. One of them smiled, addressed Adamski by name, and extended his hand. Adamski did likewise, and received a familiar greeting, a pressing of palms. These strangers, he realized, were not of the earth. The smiling man asked if he was available to come with them. Adamski said he was. They led him outside to a black sedan. The three got in and drove off into the night. As the sedan headed out of the city, the pair revealed their identity. They were contact men, living secretly among the people of Earth. One was from Mars, the other from Saturn. The three men traveled on in silence. Urban sprawl gave way to desert. Stars began to be visible in the sky. Leaving the highway, they drove along a rough road. "We have a surprise for you," said the Martian. In the distance Adamski could see something glowing on the ground. His heart beat faster as they approached it. The sedan pulled up beside a flying saucer. It resembled the one he had gazed upon in the desert. And standing beside it was the very Venusian with whom he had chatted that day. With a radiant smile, the jumpsuited figure greeted Adamski. Adamski was escorted aboard by the three spacemen, by Firkin, Ramu, and Orthon, the Venusian. Passing through a curved passageway, they entered the main cabin. It was circular with a domed ceiling. On the wall were graphs and charts. At the center of the cabin, connecting lenses in the floor and ceiling, was a column, the magnetic pole, he would learn, that propelled the saucer. Firkin and Ramu invited Adamski to join them on a curved bench beside the column. Orthon, meanwhile, had approached the control panel. Adamski felt an indescribable joy. It was dawning on him that his dream was about to be realized. He was being taken on a journey into space. With almost no sensation of movement, the ship took off. Adamski looked down into the lens and saw rooftops skimming by. Through the lens in the ceiling he saw myriads of stars. As the saucer rose, Adamski was briefed on a few of its features. Then he was told to prepare for a landing, in the mothership. The same one that had passed over the desert, and that it was now floating 8 miles above the Earth. He looked out a porthole, and caught his breath. There it was, half a mile long. The spectacle of that gigantic cigar-shaped carrier ship hanging the motionless in the stratosphere, he writes, will never dim in my memory. The saucer passed through an opening in the great ship and docked inside. The four men disembarked, and Adamski was led through the forbidding interior of a mothership. He was shown tiers of platforms filled with instruments, and a control room. Then they entered a lounge. Adamski's attention instantly was absorbed by two incredibly lovely young women who rose from a divan and came toward him. One of the women kissed Adamski on the cheek, the other brought him a goblet of clear liquid. Both were tall, had long, wavy hair, and wore gossamer robes and golden sandals. They looked at him with merry eyes, and he had the feeling these women could read his innermost thoughts. Adamski was motioned onto a divan. He sipped on his beverage as one of the women, Kalna, explained to him the purpose of a mothership. It cruised about space, she said, for the pleasure and edification of its occupants. Every citizen of the universe got to spend part of the year visiting and learning about other planets. The inhabitants of such planets were always friendly, with the sole exception of Earth. That was why the mother ships never landed on Earth. Adamski was taken to the pilot room, for a spectacular view of space. Through the window he gazed upon millions of colored lights that flickered in the blackness. And amidst this celestial fireworks display was the Earth, a ball of light shrouded in clouds. By now the ship had risen to an altitude of 50,000 miles, they rejoined Rama in the lounge. The Saturnian was seated with a man in loose, comfortable-looking clothing. The space people wear jumpsuits only while working, Adamski would learn. The man appeared to be about the same age as Adamski, the first person he had encountered on the ship who was not youthful in appearance. The goblets were refilled. Adamski sipped on the beverage, finding it delicately sweet with an elusiveness that was tantalizing. The nectar of the gods. About an hour had elapsed since his departure from Earth. Yet in that short space of time, he tells us, my whole life and understanding had opened to a far greater concept of the universe than I had gained during the 61 years of my total life on Earth. But more understanding was about to come his way. For Adamski was addressed now by that older-looking man, who turned out to be a highly evolved, thousand-year-old master. The master began to speak, and Adamski and the others listened, attentively and humbly. My son, he said, looking Adamski in the eye. And he launched into a discourse on the philosophy, wisdom, and ways of the space people. He revealed to Adamski that the entire universe is populated by human beings. Each planet, however, is at a different stage of development. Indeed, the purpose of human life is to develop. And how does a human develop? By adhering to universal law. The space people, said the master, wanted to help us understand universal law, wanted to share their wisdom with us. And why had they arrived at this moment in our history? To warn us of the perils of nuclear testing. The master spoke on and on. He touched on perfection. Paths that led upward. Nonviolence. Tolerance. Occasionally, Adamski would think of a question, and the master would read his mind and answer it. The lecture concluded with an injunction. Adamski was to return to Earth with a message of hope for his fellow man. The space people were giving him a mission, an urgent one. He was to convey their wisdom to the human race. The master rose and gazed deeply into Adamski's eyes, and the philosopher felt a new sense of strength. The master gestured farewell and departed the lounge. Everyone was silent for a moment. Then Kalna remarked that it was always a privilege to listen to the master. Adamski chatted with his hosts. They commended him for standing up to the ridicule that had been heaped upon him, and for his refusal to use his contact for self-aggrandizement or commercialism. In the face of all derision, disbelief, even when the validity of your photographs was challenged, we saw how staunch you remained to that which, within yourself, you knew to be true. More drinking of the nectar-like beverage followed. Then Ramu announced it was time to return to Earth. Adamski was led back to the saucer. He was flown back to Earth and driven to his hotel. Few words were exchanged during the drive. Adamski was absorbed in his thoughts, and Firkin, at the wheel of the sedan, left him alone. In his hotel room he sat on the edge of the bed, reflecting on his meeting with the space people. And he realized that, unbelievable as it was, he must speak of it to mankind. For the space people had made him their messenger. Adamski slept for a few hours, then took the bus back to Mount Palima. He was soon at work on Inside the Spaceships. It would relate the events of that memorable night, describe the space people and their philosophy, and tell of subsequent journeys into space. During one of these, he was flown around the moon, more than a decade before the astronauts, of Apollo 8, in a saucer. During another, he was shown an awesome scene on a television screen, the surge and swirl of interstellar dust and energy, the basic force of the universe. And in the book's most inspiring passage, Adamski describes his return to Earth after one of those rides aboard a saucer. I returned to my room in the hotel, but not to sleep. My experiences of the night had so strengthened and invigorated me that I felt like a new man, my mind awake and alert with thoughts more vivid and swift than ever before. My heart sang with joy, and my body was freshened as though from a long rest. There was much to be done this day, and tomorrow I must return to my home on the mountain, but from now on I would, to the best of my ability, live each moment as it came, complete in its fullness, serving the one intelligences man is intended to do, and for which purpose he was created. Truly, the philosopher has made the most of his flying saucer experience. Pinnacle of success, and he would continue to make the most of it, as author, lecturer, and celebrity. His books were selling, and drawing national attention to Adamski, the man who had traveled in flying saucers, who had photographed them. Not only was he in demand as a speaker, in 1958 Enca Honey, his chief assistant, completed a 4,000-mile lecture tour, but as a guest on radio and television shows. He and his followers had sold Palomar Gardens, and purchased a property further up the mountain. Among the buildings they raised on the new site were accommodations for a growing number of visitors. These included persons who came to study cosmic law, some of them widows with large bank accounts, and also a long-haired, bearded contingent, West Coast beatniks who dug the outrageousness of Adamski. Other marginal types were also showing up. Lamented Lucy McGuinness, "You would be surprised to learn how many mediums come with special messages for GA. People of all branches of religion and metaphysics drive up to enlighten and save him. Some are very difficult to talk to, but we do our best to be patient and friendly at all times." And visiting from time to time was Adamski's brother, a Catholic priest. He and George would engage in long discussions. No doubt they touched upon organized religion, of which Adamski seems to have strongly disapproved. For some time now Adamski had been coordinating a network of correspondents. These devoted followers, known as co-workers, received from Mount Palomar a newsletter, the Cosmic Bulletin, that kept them posted on the activities of the space people. They corresponded with one another and organized study groups. The network extended beyond the borders of the U.S., and was to prove useful in 1959, when George Adamski embarked upon a world tour. The tour had been prompted, he insisted, by the space people, who had told him to go forth and explain the reasons for their coming. It began in New Zealand, in January, then moved on to Australia, England, Holland, and Switzerland. Co-workers in each country had arranged meetings, lectures, and publicity. From its start, the tour was a success. The lectures, which included a film, were attended by overflow crowds. Australia was particularly gratifying. When his plane landed in Sydney, a crowd of reporters, curiosity seekers, and saucer enthusiasts, whom Adamski describes in Flying Saucers' Farewell as wonderful men and women who are dedicated to seeking out the peaceful, productive means by which we shall earn our rightful, dignified position among the civilizations of other planets, converged on him. And he held a press conference. The ensuing publicity helped fill the lecture halls. Quoted in Luzinstag, UFO.George Adamski, their man on Earth, UFO Photo Archives, 1990. Zinstag reports that he had a peculiar idiosyncrasy against entering any church. When he did so once during a visit to Rome, he turned pale and left as soon as possible. Then it was on to England, where he lectured to large crowds and appeared in a television debate with an astronomer. Adamski claims to have won the debate through sheer dignity, but the high point of the tour came in Holland. Just before his arrival, Adamski learned, to his surprise and glee, that the country's ruler, Queen Juliana, wished to meet with him. Juliana had a penchant for the mystical. Her attachment several years earlier to a faith healer had prompted calls for her abdication, but she had weathered the crisis, having heard that the man who had gone up in a flying saucer was about to visit her domain. The queen wanted to talk with a fellow. Adamski checked into a hotel in The Hague. The next day a royal limousine picked him up and drove him to the palace. As he was led inside, Adamski, pleased with himself, was saluted by guards, doormen, and attendants. The audience took place in the library. Wearing a stately blue frock, the queen was flanked by Prince Bernhard, her science advisors, and the Air Force Chief of Staff. Unable to dissuade the queen from meeting with an obvious charlatan, as they viewed Adamski, these men had sought to form a protective group about her. Adamski was nervous with anticipation, he recalls in Flying Saucers' Farewell, but a feeling of calm and ease came over me as I stood in the presence of the queen. I completely forgot all the instructions and could not remember the formalities that should have followed. Instead, I acted upon my feelings, for here was a feeling of welcome as among friends. Coffee and pastries were served. Then, for nearly 2 hours, Adamski regaled Her Majesty with an account of his adventures in space. The Queen listened politely and attentively. Her advisers, however, kept asking Adamski questions designed to discredit him. The space traveler remained undaunted. At one point he insisted officials in the US were withholding information on UFOs, and asked the Queen if the same situation might not exist in Holland. Her Majesty gave a tiny smile of acknowledgement. When the audience was over, both the Queen and the Prince shook Adamski's hand. The firmness of their handshakes impressed him. Of the princes, he would remark, it was one of those handshakes which mean more than words. I felt he was in agreement with me. And climbing back into the royal limousine, Adamski was returned to his hotel. Meanwhile, word of Juliana's meeting with a flying saucer contactee had spread, and Holland was thrown into an uproar. Declared one newspaper, a shame for our country. Another paper was more accommodating, we are not opposed to a court jester on the green lawns of the royal palace, provided he is not taken for an astronomical philosopher. In an interview the Air Force chief dismissed Adamski. The man's a pathological case. But Juliana seemed to have enjoyed her meeting with the man who had been to space. Said one of her advisers, the Queen showed an extraordinary interest in the whole subject. And Adamski, who went on to lecture before sold-out houses in The Hague and Amsterdam, stated that Her Majesty had been very interested. I wish everyone had a mind as open to progress, and I don't mean gullible, as I experienced today. The next stop on the tour was Switzerland. He was picked up at the train station and taken to a hotel by co-worker Lou Zinstag. In her George Adamski, their man on Earth, Zinstag has described his stay in Switzerland. A memorable moment, she says, came in Bâle, where she and Adamski encounter. Adamski's meeting with the Queen brings to mind Groucho Marx's encounters with a society matron played by Margaret Dumont. Zinstag was cousin to Carl Jung, the noted psychologist. In his book Flying Saucers, A Modern Myth of Things Seen in the Skies, Harcourt, Brace and Co., 1959, Jung posits that UFOs are archetypes, psychological projections that express the fears and yearnings of the unconscious, visionary images of wholeness and order. Zinstag tried unsuccessfully to convince him they were actual spacecraft, piloted by extraterrestrials. She also sought, unsuccessfully, to get him to meet with Adamski. Ted, one of the space people. They were sitting in a sidewalk cafe at the time, having a conversation. The only other patron was a blonde man in sunglasses, whom Adamski kept eyeing. The man finally got up and left, smiling at them as he walked by. Adamski explained to her that the stranger was one of the space people. But Switzerland was also the scene of something new in Adamski's career, organized hostility. The first sign that trouble was brewing came at his opening lecture in Zurich. The lecture was attended by a sympathetic audience. And when it was over, a question and answer session was held. Suddenly, a man stalked to the front and insisted that the questioning was a stage-managed sham. He also accused Adamski of being not the real Adamski, but an impersonator. The man refused to give his name and departed hastily from the hall. The following day Adamski delivered a second lecture, at a larger hall that was filled to capacity. But many in the crowd were university students who had come to disrupt the event. They proceeded to do so. After each of his sentences they stamped their feet and clapped. They hollered, sang, tossed fruit. Adamski gave up trying to speak and called for the film to be shown. But as the lights dimmed, trumpets and noisemakers began to sound. Firecrackers exploded. A searchlight was beamed at the screen. After a woman was struck by a tossed beer bottle, the police ordered everyone to leave. The students, it would seem, were simply out for some raucous fun. But Adamski blamed the disruption on the Silence Group, a cabal dedicated to suppressing the truth about flying saucers. His next scheduled stop was Rome. But the rigors of touring, the incident at Zurich, and the summer heat had taken their toll on the 68-year-old lecturer. He cancelled his remaining appearances and flew back to America. Zinstag describes his departure from the airport. While standing in a queue, he suddenly took me in his arms and gave me a huge kiss. I have seldom been so astonished in my life, of a kiss, I mean. She was one of those wonderful men and women dedicated to spreading the word about the space people, and their man on Earth was appreciative. Last year's Adamski was soon at work on another book. And in 1961 Flying Saucers Farewell, perhaps the most interesting of his works, was published by A.B. Large Schumann. It touches on such matters as farming on Venus, the mission of the space people, the principles by which they live, avoidance of negative thoughts, etc., their architecture, their attitude toward work, UFOs and the Bible, telepathy, vegetation on the moon, the propulsion system of the ships, and scientific confirmation of Adamski's findings. The book includes a refutation of charges of fakery that had been leveled against him, and an account of his world tour. The farewell in the title refers, he explains, to his having completed a preliminary study of the UFO phenomenon. Henceforth a new program of greater intellectual expansion, along technical and philosophical lines, will be carried out by myself and my associates. He would continue to explore man's place in the universe, but from a new perspective. That same year Adamski self-published a philosophic treatise called Cosmic Philosophy. Unlike his saucer books, it is abstract, didactic, and almost unreadable. Here is a sample of its prose: always you are one, you are all, as a centralized point of being. Undying, unchanging, and the consciousness, cause, and the action, evolving, transmuting a form to a unified state of awareness. The main idea of the book seems to be that the ego must be transcended, allowing the mind to vanish into the illumined vastness of cosmic intelligence. The reader is urged to tear away the veil of mystery that separates himself from the cosmic halls of wisdom. For some 87 pages Adamski expounds, or blathers, in this higher-minded fashion. Toward the end Furkan appears and relates a parable. Cosmic Philosophy does conclude with some practical advice. Adamski suggests keeping a daily ledger of your thoughts. Divide a page into two columns, one for positive thoughts, the other for negative. Constantly monitor and assess your thoughts, making marks in the appropriate column. At the end of each day tabulate your score. Over a period of time you will find that your old thought habits that caused confusion and disorder in the mind and body have disappeared. He also disseminated, via the newsletter, a series of articles on cosmic philosophy. The reaction was mixed. I for one found his elaborations becoming repetitious and, sometimes, too abstract, writes Luzinstag. She complains of having grown tired of Adamski's articles on cosmic philosophy. They were moralizing and often singularly pointless. The network of co-workers was still alive and well. They continued to correspond, publish bulletins, hold meetings and await the arrival of the space people. But Adamski's communiques to them became briefer and less frequent, and finally he put C.A. Honey in charge of the network. He had decided to concentrate, he explained, on cosmic philosophy and other vital concerns. The nature of those concerns soon became apparent. In March 1962, Adamski announced that he was about to leave for Saturn, to attend an interplanetary conference. He would bring back, he promised, the highest teachings ever given to Earth people. He would also attempt to send, from the conference, a telepathic message to co-workers around the world. They were told to meditate at a specified hour, and to have pencil and paper ready. Only one of them succeeded in receiving the message. It was a brief greeting, but all were soon receiving in the mail a copy of Report on My Trip to the 12 Counselors Meeting of Our Sun System. The Saturn Report, as it became known, was disturbing to many of his followers. The problem was not that he had gone to Saturn, they expected no less, but that he had gotten there by a disreputable means. For Adamski had traversed the millions of miles via a kind of astral travel. Astral travel involves zipping about in one's non-material body, and Adamski had denounced as frauds those claiming to have engaged in the practice. They were mystical hucksters, who undermined the credibility of authentic fellows like him. That psychic stuff, astral bodies, automatic writing, spirit entities, was nonsense, and he had told his followers to stay away from it. But now he did a turnabout, and became preoccupied with a grab bag of mystical practices. He experimented with Ouija boards and hypnotism, wrote about witchcraft, speculated on the past lives of those around him. And he engaged in trance mediumship, something the old Adamski had especially denounced. During one trance he insisted Orthon had possessed him and was speaking through him. Many of his followers were scandalized. A ride in a flying saucer, a nuts and bolts ship, had been easy for them to accept. But astral travel? Reincarnation? Possession by spacemen? These were beyond the pale of belief. C. A. Honey, who was editing the newsletter, wrote to Luzinstag, "Recent articles by George were so far out I could not publish them. Was Adamski exploring the borderlands of human experience? Or, the view of his detractors, cracking under the strain of an ongoing imposture?" Then came the matter of the postal box. In October, copies of a mysterious note were received by co-workers. The note was written in hieroglyphic characters, with an English translation, "You are doing good work. Adamski is the only one on Earth that we support." The return address was a postal box in Glendale, California. Around the same time, a classified ad, offering to put qualified persons in touch with the space people, for a fee, appeared in newspapers. The address was that same postal box. Adamski denied any connection with the note or the ad. But it was discovered that he had secretly rented the postal box. Could the old man be going off the beam, as fellow contactee Sonia Lyubn, who was staying with him at the time, was telling people? He was acting like a two-bit charlatan. His followers began to doubt Adamski. They saw him as defecting from his mission and betraying the space people. Even Lucy McGuinness, his devoted secretary of many years, left him, unable to bear what must have seemed to her a self-betrayal. Adamski's career was in decline. Yet a final moment of glory awaited him. In 1963 he flew to Copenhagen and delivered a series of lectures. Afterwards he stopped in Switzerland, for a visit with Luzinstag. She greeted him with enthusiasm. But it was not the Adamski she remembered. He had become, she says in her book, boastful, flippant, inattentive to others. Zinstag found herself dismayed by this new persona. Why the change? She speculates that he had come under the influence of malevolent spacemen. And she knew that some of his recent projects had come to naught. It does not seem to have occurred to Zinstag that he might be sagging under the weight of decades of deception. Whatever the case, his visit was proving a disappointment. At times, however, he became his old self, sincere, jovial, friendly. He would tell jokes or address some fascinating topic, and the two wound up passing a few wonderful hours of perfect understanding. Then Adamski made a startling announcement. He wanted her to accompany him to Rome, where he was scheduled to meet with the Pope. Zinstag looked at him in astonishment. "The Pope?" Adamski nodded and insisted that a meeting with the Pope had been arranged. From his pocket he took a package. It contained a message, he said, from the space people, who had asked him to deliver it to the Pope. Zinstag was dubious. But they flew to Rome, and were soon making their way to the Vatican. As they approached the Apostolic Palace, Adamski looked about for the papal representative with whom he was supposed to rendezvous. "There he is, I can see the man. Please, wait for me at this very spot in about an hour's time." He descended the steps and, going to the left, entered a doorway, from which Zinstag thought to discern someone gesturing to him. She was puzzled, though, having expected Adamski to turn right and go in at the main entrance where the Swiss guards were posted. After an hour she returned, to find Adamski waiting for her and grinning like a monkey. On his face was an unforgettable look of sheer joy. The Pope had received him, he said, and accepted the message from the space people. Adamski showed her a commemorative coin, and described how the Pope had given it to him, in appreciation of his having delivered the message. Had this meeting truly taken place? The coin dispelled any doubts Zinstag may have had. It could only have come, she told herself, from the Pope. George had met with him. Adamski returned to California with his memento. And, he sank deeper into questionable activities. He peddled instructions for traveling, via self-hypnosis, to other planets. and he published a study course that was an updated version of questions and answers by the Royal Order of Tibet with all references to Tibetan masters altered to Space Brothers or Cosmic Brotherhood.